eyes. Yeah, that's great. This fucking cat just sat right, in front of me. Otter.
That's your cat's name, Otter?
No, well, it's my roommate's cat, but he's taking a liking to me.
Nice.
And I was never a cat person, but I gotta say he's pretty fucking cute. So slowly changing my mind. I'm just taking cats seriously over here, you know.
I guess, yeah, so there's one thing that's new on my side that I didn't tell you about, which is that I'm going to be a dad, man.
What? Dude, yeah. Are you serious?
Yeah.
Holy shit, so I was congrats, like, dude. Oh, my God. What the? You just forgot? You just forgot about that one?
No, I was like,
what's new and nothing
much. I was like, I got to warm up to it a little bit. Like, it's some big news. I wanted to make sure I was being a bit more fluid. But yeah, so, like, Helena's, like, second trimester, and we're like preparing to have a kid and stuff, and it's
holy
kind of
fuck.
Like,
that's so cool, dude. You're gonna be such a good dad. Oh my god, I'm stoked.
I'm excited because like I taught guitar for like 10 years to kids, and kind of haven't done that very much anymore. But like, I just love children, and I'm like stoked to have one, and like just enter the next phase of our lives, I guess. And so yeah, so that's it. Like the other thing that's kind of weird about that is like you have to kind of be secretive about it for the first trimester or so, because like miscarriage rates are high and stuff, so you kind of feel like you have a secret for a while, and so it's nice to just like tell you so that we can like be on the same page. But yeah, man, so
dude,
that's like
huge congrats, that's so dope.
Looking forward to it. 31, you know, ready for the next phase of our lives. And and I guess the other thing that's kind of weird is like our kids, so we don't know the gender yet, but like they're probably going to hear this podcast at some point in like in the distant future. And it'll be an interesting, I think, like moment when they're older and then they get to hear their like dad being young and naive and working through a bunch of issues, like live and stuff. And so I always like kind of wondered what that was going to be like decades from now. And,
they'll be a true Popperian and will have solved all of these problems by the age 12 and then be like, I'm listening to you at 30 and you're not making any sense. What are you talking about? These are easy problems.
They're going to hear these bloody ideas so much in the household.
But the question is, how seriously are you going to take your child?
So that's the thing is like, we were going to do an episode on like the taking children seriously movement, which is out of Deutsch, and talk about parenting and stuff, and I still want to do that, but I'm not prepared enough to do that. So like I had this whole plan of like we would do a parenting episode and then I would start with this like parenting announcement just to really like to like tie the whole thing together, to raise the stakes, to just like psych you out, and then but we didn't get our stuff together in time, but that's part of the reason why I'm interested in the whole like taking children seriously like movement, because
of course,
like, having to think about like parenting styles and stuff. But I guess our audience doesn't know what TCS is, and so we should probably do a full episode on that at some point. I guess just for listeners, like if you Google taking children seriously, you'll see David Deutsch and Sarah Fitz-Klarich.
Yep.
Is that their website, and it's a parenting movement built around Popperianism and also libertarianism. I think there's an interesting mixture of the two. And so in back channels, you and I have been talking about like what exactly we think about that. And we still haven't figured it out, but
scared to make our views public.
Yes, exactly. Cause people think, take it very seriously, and I'm still a bit on the skeptical side, but I'm not entirely sure. So we have to sort out our, prior thoughts there, but that's part of the reason why I've been interested in that. Cause I have to think about freaking parenting styles now.
Yeah, no kidding, dude.
I know, dude.
Wow, you better be freaking homeschooling your kid, or else I'm gonna send the coercion police after you.
Lock them up in the institution of public education systems and stuff.
But, pure evil.
Yeah, pure evil.
Fucking evil.
But we'll save that conversation, I guess, for another time. But yeah, so that's a big announcement. You finally know. I don't have to feel like I'm holding a secret from you anymore. I think you might honestly be the last person to know, because we've told your parents like a week and a half ago. And
I was just going to ask, can I tell my parents?
Yeah, your parents. No, parents, I've actually had to tell your parents not to tell you, because I'm like, I want to tell Ben on the podcast. And we had to keep rescheduling. So your parents have known for like 2 weeks.
Wow. My parents kept asking, when's the next podcast episode? And I was like, they don't give a shit about the podcast. Like, they're like, oh, maybe I'll listen to the episode that came out. I don't really care. And I was like, why are they taking such a keen interest in the podcast? Like, I know you guys don't really care about it that much. And so now I understand, of course. It was just an instrumental good.
That's exactly right.
They really don't care about the podcast.
They just like, because my parents, we told my parents, I guess like 3 weeks ago, 2 weeks ago, and then they told your parents immediately. And then I had to send like a panic text, like, don't do that yet, because I want to tell them on the podcast. But yeah, so now I think you're the last person to know. And once this is released, the whole world will know.
I don't think you had much to worry about, because the track record between our parents means that once the message got to me, starting with your parents, it would be so garbled that it wouldn't come out as you having a kid. It would be like, Baden is becoming a full-time babysitter for someone else's child.
Benjamin Button syndrome. He's regressing to become a child. That kind of
thing. Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
So you better wrap up the podcast quick, because Baden's going to revert into teenager mode pretty quickly here.
But cool. So that's off my chest. Now you know. Everything is good. Life is groovy. Jesus. And prepare to hear a lot about changing diapers and stuff from your co-host. So we'll definitely have to bring Danny.
Dude, that's so much pressure. Now that I know your kid's going to be listening to us, like, I got to sound like I know what the fuck I'm talking about, you know?
We're going to play the podcast to like in their cradle and stuff. just be all weird about it.
You can definitely fall asleep to this. No problem.
Introduction to the philosophy of probability.
God.
Day 6. But cool. Yeah. So I don't know. One more beer and then we'll get into the subject.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the topic for today is to explain Popper's three worlds, which is a concept which I use in my thinking quite a lot. And I guess yesterday we were in a reading group and I realized that the way I think
that you were wrong.
I realized I was wrong. But but I realized that the way I think about it is very different to the way that other Popperians think about this concept. And our friend of the podcast, Chesto, he actually tweeted to David Deutsch about this subject this morning, and Deutsch thinks about it in a different way. And so we decided to structure this episode around the concept of Popper's three worlds, because I guess you have some problems with what it is saying, and there's a interesting...
Or at least what you're saying, it's saying.
Yeah, okay. So then that's the other aspect of it, which is people don't agree with my interpretation of it, but I think the interpretation is pretty fucking obvious. But yeah, so we thought we would do an episode talking about Popper's three worlds and how that overlaps and plays with David Deutsch's conception of abstractions. And so in the broadest possible sense, the question is like, what does it mean to say something is real? What does reality consist of? And so Popper's three worlds is the following. So he says that you can broadly categorize the things in our universe into three camps. So the first camp, the first world, is just the world of material objects. So rocks and mountains and stars and gas, photons, that kind of thing. The second world is the world of experience, subjective experience. So this is stuff like pain and pleasure, happiness, the feeling of love, phenomenology, is a subjective experience, the domain of qualia. And the second world is unbelievably important, because this is where moral considerations reside. So I think somewhere Popper says that the second world is of the utmost importance, precisely because this is how we anchor our moral considerations. And then the third world is the world of the products of human thought. So in this world would fit things like Beethoven's Sonata, fiction, Harry Potter, mathematics, language, architecture, cathedrals, anything that human beings have produced that exists independently of the human mind, but can affect the first world through the second world. So how do we know the third world exists? It's because the products of human cognition can affect changes in the first world via the second world. So a human has an idea of a cathedral and then designs architectural blueprints and schematics and then gets bulldozers and creates a cathedral. So the third world concept, a cathedral, can then be instantiated into the first world via the second. So that's my understanding of the three worlds, and maybe I'll pause there to have you react to that. But I guess there's a fascinating disagreement between Popper's notion of what it means for abstract entities to exist. So he puts things like knowledge and theories into the third world, and David Deutsch's conception of what it means for abstract entities to exist.
Okay, that was great. I guess I just want to emphasize a couple points there. So I think one is that these worlds are not independent, which you laid out, right? So world three, so not only is world three the products of the human mind, but it itself affects world one, like the physical things we see around us, and this interaction takes place by means of world two. And so any sort of invention that we make can be seen via this lens. So we have conjectured thoughts and ideas. These ideas have logical consequences, and theories have reach. Theories say things, they posit things about the world, and then from these consequences we can build bridges or build cryptography systems or build computers or build the internet. So this is not a one-way street at all. These are like these three worlds interacting. But would you say that it's only, they're interacting, but never world one and world three are interacting? It's only by means of world two?
Yeah, that's Popper's conception, that world two is the intermediary between world three and world one. So specifically what that means is if there's no humans, or generalizing it to just intelligent agents to understand theories, then there's no way that the world three products can cause change in the material world.
Nice. Perfect. Okay. So we have these three worlds, and at the beginning, you open this up by saying this is a conversation about what constitutes reality. So your claim here and Popper's claim here and my claim here is that world three, we should consider world three as real. Is that right?
100%.
Yeah. So these are, and so this has somewhat surprising consequences for our intuitions, or at least it did have for my intuitions when I first sort of thought about this, which I think my conception of reality before this was largely physical. Like, I hadn't thought about what constitutes reality much before, but I think most people are walking around with the notion in their head that like reality is physical stuff. It's tables, it's chairs, it's humans, and that sort of abstract ideas, even though they might play an important role in our inventions and stuff, they're not real. But Popper's arguing, look, these ideas can sort of take on a life of their own, right? Once you have the notion of something like the natural numbers, there's certain properties that now follow from the natural numbers, like prime numbers and divisibility and like consequences that we can start investigating, and that importantly, like, we don't conjecture in the first place. So, you know, the whole field of number theory is an example of this, where you can start asking really hard questions about these abstractions, and so in this way they take on a life of their own, and because they sort of have this effect whereby they take on this sort of independent properties, or rather their properties are like independent of our initial conjectures, and they start affecting the world, we should ascribe to them like a certain reality.
So Popper would say that something is real if it can cause changes in the physical material around us. So it might be worthwhile to contrast this view to the view called reductionism, which is that the stuff is real if it's at its the lowest level of reality. So we would not say, for example, in this view, that the stock market is real. We would say electrons are real, and the stock market is just some approximation of what a bunch of electrons are doing moving around people's smartphones. But we know that the stock market isn't actually real. It's just maybe a useful way to talk about it. But if we really want to study reality, we should not study the stock market. We should study electrons. That would be we should reduce all of the things we see around us to the smallest constituents and study that. And so under the Popperian third worldview, the stock market is as real as electrons because it can cause change in, say, buildings around you. They can become foreclosed because the stock market dips, for example. So it's very much the domain of what constitutes things that are real and what doesn't.
Yeah. So how does this play? So the other sort of theory that I know of in this space comes from, Deutsch. And I've actually never really thought about the comparison between Deutsch and Popper's three worlds much before, but Deutsch has this whole thing about the reality of abstractions, right? So what we call real are things required by our best explanations of certain phenomenons. So the stock market factors into our best explanation of the economy and stuff. And so we have a right to call this real. Same with our physical theories that predict like the existence of electrons and what's going on inside of stars and quasars and black holes and stuff before we had like empirical evidence for this. Deutsch would say, because these are elements that are either predicted by or crucial to our best theories for a given problem, we have a right to call these things real and ascribe reality to these elements. And so because the best explanation for a lot of things is at the emergent level, like the best explanation for a lot of human behavior involves explanations that's not like the molecular level. It's not at the most basic level of physical atoms and stuff. So like the law and supply and demand, we call that real because it factors into our best explanation of like certain economic observations. So how does this relate to Popper's three worlds in your view?
So up until this morning, I thought that these were completely congruent and basically just two different ways to talk about the same thing. And I think that's almost 90% true because the best explanation criteria for reality, one of the big emphasis is it's against reductionism. So it's not that only photons and electrons are real, but things at higher levels of emergence are as real as photons. And this, to me, makes complete perfect sense, because what about a hammer? Is a hammer at a higher level of emergence, or is it just a bunch of atoms? The reductionist view would say that hammers don't even exist, because all we can talk about are electrons. But obviously hammers exist. And so in that sense, it's congruent with Popper's. And then what both Deutsch and Popper do is they go above and beyond just the physical, and they say there's this plane of reality that we're going to call abstractions that are as real as anything physical. So moving away from the reductionism thing, there's another view which they're pushing back against, and that's, I guess, like physicalism or materialism, which says that the only things that are real are physical, touchable stuff, right? So I think Hitchens was a materialist, and I used to be a materialist until I learned about the reality of abstractions, because there are concepts like patterns or information or computation or knowledge, which are very much non-physical, but both Popper and Deutsch want to say they are real and they're abstractions. So up until now, I think Popper and Deutsch completely agree. I think the place where they disagree is very subtle, but it's on the definition of abstraction, what counts as an abstraction, what an abstraction actually refers to, and also on this human dependence thing. So I discovered that there is a sharp difference between the Popperian and the Deutschian worldview through conversations with some friends of ours, Philos and Danny, who I don't know if they listen to the podcast, but shout out to Philos and Danny.
Danny better, because he's going to be a fucking guest soon, so yeah, he's not listening. Screw him.
Yeah, exactly. but the sharp distinction is, let's take an example like prime numbers.
Yeah, nice.
So under the Deutschian view, and I want to be careful that I don't actually know if Deutsch is saying this, because I reread the Reality of Abstractions chapter, and it's actually ambiguous what he means when he says abstraction. Huh. And it's one of the few words that he doesn't define at the end of the chapter. So I don't think there's a definition. So I don't know if he's totally pinpointed what he means here either. But under the Deutschian view, abstractions exist completely independently of people. And therefore, things like prime numbers would exist even if the universe was filled with only gas. Under the Popperian view and under my view, I say my view because I'm influenced by Popper, and so there's not a big difference between Popper and myself on this particular point. Prime numbers are a world three object, meaning they are contingent upon humans existing. So if humans didn't exist, prime numbers wouldn't exist either. I think the third view we should add in and see what you think about this is this notion of Platonic forms, which is that there exists things like triangles and the Pythagorean theorem in this like ephemeral, like transcendental state that's just, it's always existed, it always will exist. Mm-hmm. And they are, and this intuition, I think, that like there's something timeless about the Pythagorean theorem is what leads a lot of mathematicians to be basically Platonists. It's like they're not inventing mathematics, they are discovering it. They are, I think yesterday I used the phrase like you're just plugging into something that's already existent, almost in like a matrix style way. And so the thing that Popper's not saying, and the thing that maybe we will start to disagree about, is that abstractions in the sense of the prime numbers and the natural numbers, these are only consequences of human thought. They are not some ephemeral, ethereal thing that has always existed and always will exist independently of humans. It is a human product. And that's, I think, what Deutsch would disagree with, or at least it is currently ambiguous in his book whether or not he would agree with this or not. So that's how I see these views relating. It's the human dependence on abstractions, which I think is the strong dividing line between the two views.
Nice. Yeah, okay. So yeah, I do disagree there, so we could dive into that, but I want to step backwards for a second and just, I think this can be hard to follow, so I just want to summarize and question. So yeah. I see the reality of explanations as like a very nice way of answering the question about like what we know and what we consider real and how that's evolving over time according to like our, because we're converging on like better and better theories of reality. We'll just like confine the purview of the combo to physics for the moment, just for clarity. Right, so our theories are evolving over time, presumably they're becoming better and better approximations of reality. This is changing what we know, what we consider real. But in Popper's third world, good theories and bad theories, they're all still just products of the human mind. So when you say all of those things are real, it seems like the consequences of the good and bad theories, even theories we know to be false, are still real. So like how does he draw the distinction between like, so it seems like in Popper, to make it concrete, like the gravitational force is still an abstraction in Popper's third world that we would consider real.
Interesting. Okay, so to generalize, it's like, what do we do with falsified theories? Are falsified theories in the third world?
That's
and of course,
that's a better fucking way to say it.
Yeah, so of course, falsified theories are still the products of the human mind. And it's not, so Popper makes a very important distinction between the third world, which contains all of it, and knowledge. So knowledge is an inhabitant of the third world, but it's not the same as the third world. The third world also includes fiction. And it includes a bunch of dead theories and theories which are tentative and yet to be proven. And so at a certain point, a theory in the third world becomes so it's tested so frequently, so it has resisted repeated attempts at falsification, and it is the beautiful hard to vary thing that Deutsch highlights, that it updates our view of what the first world consists of. So before we had a theory of dinosaurs, we would describe the first world differently than after we have a theory of dinosaurs. And so the first world is the world of the physical. But we don't know exactly what that really means. So the first world is continuously updatable in terms of what we even say is in the first world.
Or our knowledge.
Our knowledge of the first world. Exactly. And that's it. So the third world is just the product of all sorts of human thought. And some of these thoughts we think are true. And if it's true, that means that it corresponds to reality in some important sense. And then that updates what we consider to be real. And if these true theories, these hard-to-vary explanations, are about forces, then we take a concept like forces and we say, okay, that constitutes our reality. And then if later we find out it's not true, then that changes what we think about the first world. Similarly, we can talk about the same things going on. The same thing goes on with the second world as we learn more about different mental states. Presumably there's a time before we knew about color blindness. And so we would have described the second world without reference to the fact that some people can experience colors. But now we know about that, then that updates what we consider to be in the second world.
Okay, I'm getting confused by your use of the word reality here. So I thought at the beginning of the conversation you said the three worlds sculpt what we're going to talk about as real. So we're going to talk about all of this as real, world one, world two, world three. But then, obviously, yeah, just stop me when I'm wrong. But then you said, okay, certain products of the human mind, some subset of these products constitute our best theories, and these update what we consider reality. So you know, right? You just use the word, but those are in world three, which you've just said constitute reality. So there's the reality of what we perceive world one to be, but you've just argued, but nice, world one is not all that constitutes reality, right? So these false theories are also real.
Excellent. Yeah. So the word reality is overloaded in an unhelpful way.
Exactly.
Let's just take fiction. So is Harry Potter real? Well, in one sense, obviously it is, because you can go buy a book that says Harry Potter on it. But it's not a theory about, let's say, the fundamental properties of the universe. Would that be a way to distinguish between real in the physics sense, in the sense of finding out the laws of the universe? So let's create two words. So let me say how the universe works for one notion of reality, but also just stuff that is in the universe as a second notion of reality. So poetry and dead theories and falsified hypotheses, all of that is stuff that's in the universe. But it is not the same as improving our fundamental understanding of how the universe works. So does introducing a split between how the universe works and what is inside the universe clear up the difficulties?
Nice. Yeah, I think so. So now, to paraphrase you, Popper's Three Worlds is a theory about what's real, or a claim about what's real, just what's in the universe, where, and then some of the products of the human mind, which are in the third world, some subset of these will be theories of physics that tell us how the world
how,
works.
Yeah, exactly. How
or
the
how
universe
the physical
works.
World works. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, they're whys. They are the trying to answer the why question. Like, why do particles move together? One answer is it's because there's a force. Another answer is because space-time is curved and they follow paths that are geodesics. The third world can contain true and false theories. And the true theories are those which we then use to update our conception of what the universe consists of. So why things get confusing is you can talk about the reality of false theories.
Yeah, exactly.
Communism is presumably a false theory, but it's very, very fucking real, right? And that's where it gets a little bit hairy, but it's still quite important to distinguish between. The ingredient of truth will then update our conception, but you still... In another sense of the word real, communism is still real. It's just that
it's just false.
It's just real but false.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So only just some subset of World Three is actually true theories. And
exactly.
The rest are real theories, but they're just false.
And so this is in agreement with Popper's notion of content, right? So most of our theories are wrong, but even false theories can have truth content. And so where does content reside? It all resides in the third world. But when you say something is true, then you're referring to stuff in reality. And so I could say that, for example, communism was invented by a person named Schmarl Schmarks. So that would be a false statement. So there could be a true statement about a false theory of communism, and that's why things get confusing. But it's important to distinguish between these various notions.
Nice. Okay. Yeah, this is nice. I think I agree with all of this. My disagreement comes from the conditional nature of this existence, I think. So in World 3, we have something like the prime numbers and their properties. So certain theorems that hold about the primes, about natural numbers in general, just like mathematical theorems. And I take it you want to argue that if humans had never been around, or if humans disappeared tomorrow, these things would cease to exist.
Yes, but there's a bunch of caveats there. And so yesterday you didn't accept this replacement of the question. I'll see if you accept it now, but if not, then I'll stay with it. So I want to replace the question with, did the prime numbers exist before human beings were created, or before human beings came onto the scene? Do you accept that replacement, or is that...
I will tentatively accept it until I'm proven wrong, and then I will revert to not accepting it.
I think somebody said to do that replacement is to basically bait the question, and so I don't want to do that, but I hope to clear up some layers of complexity, because we haven't talked about math yet. Mm-hmm. And so we've talked about there's these subtle but different notions of reality, what it means to say a theory is real. And then that picture gets confusing. So that already is confusing quite quickly. But now another layer of confusion is when we add mathematics into mm-hmm. it, because now you have an additional notion of truth. Which isn't referring to something extra,
physical,
something outside. It's a notion of like preserved truth or mm-hmm. entailed truth. And
like here truth given certain assumptions.
Yeah. So to say like a mathematical theory is false isn't necessarily to say that it doesn't pertain to the real world. It could also be the case that it just doesn't follow the rules of the mathematical system in which you're operating, right? Mm-hmm. So you have the second notion of truth and falsity, so things get confusing.
Yeah.
So as an attempt to reduce confusion, I want to replace the question of if humans stopped existing to what was true before humans existed.
Nice, yeah.
Yeah, if that's okay.
I will agree for now. We'll see what happens. Okay, but I also wanted to stop and give maybe the audience an example of like working true within a system, because I think people, if you're not that familiar with math, you might be confused by that. So you might think like, you know, basic arithmetic, you know, 1 + 1 is 2. And you kind of see that as like a true claim. And it's almost a true claim about the world. If you have two objects, you put them, or if you have one object and you bring in another object to the room, you now have two objects, and you can sort of fail to distinguish there between the formal mathematical system you're working in and reality. But the way to see this is to just consider the example of like not working within the natural numbers. So when you say like 1 + 1 = 2, you're working within like, well, you could be working within a lot of systems, but you could just be working within your normal number system, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, all the way up to infinity. But there's other number systems which are just finite and cyclical. So if you work like modulo 2, for example, and modulo just is like the rules of arithmetic followed by your clock, right? So your clock is just modulo either 12 or 24, whether you're on normal time or military time. And so you don't go, when you're 24 and you add an hour, you go to 0, or you go to 1, I guess. You don't go to 25. And so now when you're talking about the clock arithmetic, 1 + 1, I guess, is still 2, but 24 + 1 is not 25. And so those facts don't correspond to reality in any sense. That's just a fact about the mathematical assumptions you're making in your system. And so anyway, when you're talking about something can be true or not, depending on sort of the axioms you've chosen, depending on the formal system you're working in, that's what you mean. So it's truth relative to a standard that we've all sort of agreed upon a priori. And now within those standards, we can start arguing about what are true theorems and false theorems and et cetera. But it's all based on these assumptions we've made in the background.
Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. I am going to use the clock example in the future, because to say 24 + 1 = 25, and people are like, obviously that's true. But it's also true to say 24 + 1 = 1. If you go 1 hour past 24, you're going to get to 1 a.m. And how can they both be true? Well, it's true with respect to the rules of your formal system, mm-hmm. your formal language. And I would encourage listeners who are... So when I say formal language or formal system, just Google it, because there's a whole Wikipedia page in reference to this kind of thing. And it's not just an adjective. It's like it's a proper noun. Mm. And programming languages are formal languages. The number system is a formal system. Binary is a formal system. And so that's a very different notion of truth, but it is very important to recognize that there's two notions of truth, and they relate, but they're different. Okay, so back to your question of did the prime numbers exist before human beings? I say no, because I see the prime numbers as basically the just what you discover in a formal system. So what humans haven't done is they've invented these unbelievably powerful formal languages, formal systems. And some of them, so the clock arithmetic is quite a simple one, but if you invent the real numbers, that's also a formal system. And when you invent a certain set of rules that are so powerful that you don't know all the possible ways to combine them and the things you can discover when you combine them in different ways, then you have an infinite amount of discoveries in front of you. And then that's what's so beautiful and powerful about inventing these formal languages. And so the prime numbers, I think, exist only in with respect to these formal languages. And in the same way that I don't think it would make any sense at all to discuss or even consider, like, would English exist before human beings? I don't think it makes sense to talk about would the natural numbers exist before human beings, because both are formal systems. And so if the natural numbers don't exist, then anything contained within them also don't exist. Maybe I'll leave it there, but I recognize that the problem with that, or the reason why people have a difficult time with that view, is because there seems to be something way more fundamental, way more pure about mathematics that isn't the case with other languages, with other like with English, for example. But I think it's all the same thing.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, there's a couple good things there. So the intuition that I can't escape is that because we don't get to choose the logical consequences of these formal systems, that so you use the word discovery, right? So what you're doing is invent conjecture, whatever, the natural numbers, and so now you're dealing with this formal system, but the consequences of that system, its completeness, its properties, what you can prove within it, what's true and what's not true with respect to that system, are not up to you. And so to say that now those consequences would cease to exist, that 7 would cease to be prime if humans disappeared or if humans hadn't come around, doesn't make sense to me. I'll let you respond to that, and then I'll talk the English point, which...
Yeah, so the consequences definitely are not our choosing. Of course, but to say... So we agree that prime numbers are a consequence of the natural number axiomatization, yeah? And so to say, like, what's the definition of a consequence? A consequence is something that would not happen had the first thing not happened. It's a logical consequence. But so let's not think about the word logical, but let's think about the consequence. So if you don't have the axioms, then you don't have the consequences. We don't choose the consequences. That's what's so magical and so awe-inspiring about how these things work. But if we don't invent the axioms, then there are no consequences. And then that's my answer. Like, what does it mean to say that a consequence exists had human beings not invented the thing that kicks it off? Again, we don't choose what are logical consequences, and how logical consequences work is an interesting subject, and one that we need to dive into. But the fact that it is not our choice doesn't mean it has a priori existence without it.
I'm sort of just hitting rock bottom intuition here. I'm not sure how to, like, if 7, so if we disappeared, yeah, there's something powerful about us, the intuition of us disappearing, but like, so if we disappeared and then there's another civilization that crops up in a year, and they're working with the same formal system of natural numbers,
they're going to
discover
the same
making
thing.
The same discoveries.
Yeah, of course. Right. If they are working with the same formal system, then yes, of course. Yeah. And so it's a question.
And so
of,
those discoveries are independent of us. They exist without us.
They are in the formal system, right? And so some things, like the natural numbers, are just so intuitive and so like borderline obvious because the world around you just furnishes you with...
No, it doesn't rely on that. My argument doesn't rely on that. So take something complicated. Like, I think last night you talked about chess. We can just talk about chess. Chess is not an obvious game to come up with, right? So, but the moves that win chess... So once you've posited chess, the moves that are winning moves, or how many possibilities there are, or whether the game is like decidable or not, is not... That's not up to us. Those truths, those realities exist independently of us, and they're just not contingent on us. They're not contingent on humans, right? So the fact that chess has, what are some weird properties about chess? I mean, I think there's a certain number of combination of moves, And I forget if chess has the property where there will always be a winner or loser. Like if you played...
Like are ties allowed or whatever?
Yeah, yeah. There's like a certain property of two-player games that... Anyway, whatever those properties are. Those are independent of humans. We don't get to choose those properties. Yeah, yeah. And so I want to say those properties exist without us.
Interesting. So I agree with that. Of course I do. I think we're just talking slightly past each other. And let me think of a way to...
I had a good example, I think. But
okay, you go. Because I had a realization too, but you go first.
All right. My example, let's see if I can try and make this work. What I want to do, I'll just put my cards on the table at the beginning, and then maybe you can help me. You can help me with my example. What I want to do is play with the interaction in the third world between truth and reality. So humans posited things like certain axioms of computer science, certain things about computational complexity. There are certain results, namely that like factoring... is, or reverse factoring, I guess, is like a computationally complex operation. Okay, and this has consequences for cryptography. This is why all our systems are secure. It's because like multiplying two giant numbers together is easy, but finding the numbers that went into multiplying a big number is hard if the original numbers were prime. Okay, so now in Popper's Three Worlds, we're working with like the reality of all these things. Now, if humans never existed, the fact that computation is difficult or easy under certain circumstances does not disappear. What I'm trying to fucking do here is basically link. I'm trying to show that there's not a clear line between our theories which describe physical reality and our theories which seem purely abstract. So like number theory, and the reason I gravitated to number theory is because at first that seemed like a completely abstract system that had nothing to say about the world, but it turned out that that had severe consequences for computation in the world. And computation is a physical thing, right? It places bounds on physical systems for how quickly or not they can compute things. Is this doing anything for you, or is this...
I understand the concern and the rock bottom intuition. So it's something like, Vaden, I get that you're saying that formal systems are created by human beings. And I also get the logical consequence thing. But if we didn't invent formal systems, we would still be able to have cryptography. And it still seems fundamental that factoring non-prime numbers into primes is going to be a hard task whether or not we invented formal systems. And so you can't just like get rid of the difficulty of that task by saying that like it's entirely dependent on us. And it's not like just this like almost relativist position I'm espousing, that it's just human cognition. Is that close?
I think so.
Yeah. Is that close?
I think so. Yeah. Let me see what you do with that, and then I'll determine if it was.
Yeah. So this is the really difficult and interesting question of like, why does mathematics apply to reality at all? So that subject is a huge and rich one, which we should go into and have some ideas, the way that I would approach this problem is first saying mathematics is a human construct. The conclusions are not, but the mathematics definitely is. Let me say the axioms definitely are. And then asking the second question of why does this human construct fit onto reality so bloody well? It seems like you want to say, because it fits so well, therefore it can't be a human construct. But I would pose it as a sequence of two in that way. So before I start going down that path, I don't know if you accept that or not, but I would say something additional, which is you had said, like, the fact that the prime numbers exist is not just our choice. And then I realized that, no, it absolutely is our choice, because if we came up with only a binary system, the prime numbers wouldn't exist. Prime numbers only exist in the context of the natural number system. But if we came up with purely a binary system, then the natural prime numbers wouldn't exist, unless you want to, out of the binary system, create natural numbers out of it, which obviously you can, because that's what computers do. But if we came up with just the real number system, then again, prime numbers wouldn't exist. And so these are consequences of our axioms. And then the question is, why the hell are these axioms so... why the hell are some axioms able to describe reality in such a powerful way? That would be... So I didn't answer the question, but I tried to reformulate it in a way that I think would allow us to answer it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm less concerned by the question about why some of these things help describe reality. It seems like there the answer is just something like, well, we're positing an awful lot of these systems, and when we're talking about physics, what we're doing to some extent is just looking. We have this whole wide world of pure math available to us, and we're looking through this world. We're positing a bunch of formal systems and seeing which ones work. Exactly. And so it's like a process of carving out from the space of all possible formal systems and theories which ones fit reality. And because reality is inherently computational and mathematical, and mathematics can capture computation, right? If you choose the right formal system, then it's not a surprise that we can describe that some of these formal systems describe reality because they describe computation.
So I totally agree. That's great. So then why is it a surprise that the prime numbers are a particularly apt description of some aspects of reality, particularly the difficulties of computations?
Well, what I'm trying to get at is it's not like if humans disappeared, it's meaningless to say that primes lose certain properties or that factoring numbers in certain ways is hard. That remains a fact about the world. And so there's no clear...
Does it? That seems to me to remain a fact of the formal system.
Why I think this is because you just asked the question, if humans had never come up with the natural numbers, then primes wouldn't exist. And that's just full stop. Like, yeah, they would. Because they would still have, true and false properties.
The true and, but this presupposes our knowledge of it though, right? When you say they still have true and false properties, what you're saying is assuming the natural number system and assuming we don't want the number 7 to be allowed to be divisible by 3. Of course, we can make it be divisible by 3 and then primes are gone.
True and false, right? Is always relative to a system, though. Like the true and false system, for physical systems.
No, but this is the subtlety, right? So it's true and false is relative to reality in some contexts, but in mathematics is relative to the axioms of the system. So to say that the theory of the Big Bang is true is not relative to... Actually, to say that dropping an apple, it will gravitate towards the Earth. I can change my system all day, and that's going to happen, right? And so, like, primes are almost a really interesting example because we defined them. Like, there is nothing stopping us from dividing 7 by 3. We just say that if we disallow decimal numbers, if we have to stay within the confines of the natural number system, then there's this thing called primes, which don't allow you to do that. And then we can study those properties, right? But... And then we can design cryptographic systems around that fact. But I would say that if we, for some reason, didn't discover the prime numbers, and I say discover not in a contradictory way, the discovery is that it's consequence of our axioms. If we didn't discover that, then we may not have designed cryptographic systems to use that discovery, right?
Yeah, that's fun. There's lots of discoveries we haven't made yet.
But like, if you were to go looking through the galaxy, where would you find a prime number?
Like the swimming.
The audience can't see us like swim. Like, just like scuba diving through the universe looking for a prime number.
Well, now you're confusing physical reality with the reality of math and abstractions. Of course, you're not going to just observe a seven floating in front of you, but you never do.
But this is my point. Like, the way that you can talk coherently about all this is to say that those kinds of abstractions, which are different from the abstractions of informations and patterns, which Deutsch likes to talk about, are describable as the consequences of our systems. So, like, in the same way that you wouldn't have the Queen's Gambit chess move had we not invented chess, you wouldn't have this notion of prime numbers had we not invented the natural number system. But we invent it, we discover this, and then we build societies around these concepts. And that's great. And that's amazing. It's taking conjectures seriously. Like, why are conjectures so powerful, right? Because they have all this extra information inside them that we can discover.
Because they have content that's not up to us.
because they exist
without us.
But to say that the content isn't up to us, like, what is the intuition that we're just not able to talk across? Because I acknowledge that the content isn't up to us, but it's still contained within it, right? Like, to talk about the content of a false theory, maybe that's a good way to talk about it. So let's take a good theory. Let's take Newton again. Has a butt ton of content, but it's false. And now what do you do with that? So the fact that there's content there, would you say that the content of the theory existed before us?
Yeah, I would say the logical consequences of the theory. It's just the same as like any formal system, right? Once you posit certain assumptions about Newtonian mechanics, it's the same as discovering truths about certain arithmetical systems after you posit certain number systems. It's the same thing.
So I think we totally understand. It's just one another's view. It's just that we can't cross this intuition gap.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to find the right example to penetrate it. So maybe it's this notion of logical consequences we really need to dig into, like what that actually means. Because we do have a choice in the matter in some interesting sense. Like, so what is like the history of logic? Let's be grandiose for a second. The Socratics and the Aristotelians, the Stoics and the Aristotelians, I think they both investigated logic independently. And so there's like a Stoic logic and a Aristotelian logic.
I mean, you can use different logical systems, right? Paralogic or something, but that's again still just like its own formal system.
But what is a logical system? A logical system is a set of operations that allow you to preserve truth, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I can take certain objects, so statements or mathematical objects, and I can manipulate them in such a way that truth will be preserved. So we call these like rules of inference.
Yeah.
But we can discover new rules of inference. We can create
we can discard the law of the excluded middle or something. Yeah.
And so the rules of inference in some sense are conjectures or their discovery. I'm being sloppy.
I mean, they're choices, I would say, we make.
We are continuously discovering new ways and inventing new ways to preserve truth. And this is why mathematics is a burgeoning field, is a field which continuously
this new thing called math. It's gonna be big. Maybe.
That's ridiculous.
Invest now.
That's why mathematics is a field which is continuously coming up with new things to say. And so what do you do with that? Do you say that that all of these proof techniques have just always existed before human beings, and that like when we conjecture them, it's not a act of creativity, but it's just tapping into something which has always been? It's a new creative act that allows us to preserve truth in a new way, right? But I don't like to say that these, from my side of the aisle, it sounds as if you're saying that like the conjectures have always been there, and human beings are just reaching up into the heavens and plucking out a conjecture which has always existed. And it's like, no, this is a creative, active, effortful act of human thought. And one of these kinds of thoughts are, how can we manipulate symbols in a way that will preserve truth? And you want to say something like, because it's truth preserving, it's somehow timeless. It's somehow always existent. It's always been there.
It's not conditional on the logic system, though. Or rather, I guess it is conditional. So I would just view it as like a formal system plus your rules of inference, then allow you to, within that system, start making claims about what's true and false. So you could work with the natural number systems and some weird system of logic, say, whereby maybe false implies true is false or something, instead of false implies true is true, like it is in normal logic, right? Now you're not going to get very far, or at least nothing's going to be very interesting, because now all of a sudden everything could be true. So that's just a not interesting system, right? So we chose to some extent the wrong rules of inference there.
Exactly.
We just chose silly rules of inference, right? But the natural number systems combined with traditional rules of inference, right? Not like quantum shit, but just normal Boolean logic, lead to very interesting results.
And
these results were not up to us.
but the question is like, why are some rules of inference better fit to reality than others?
The same reason why why I just gave it for math in general. Just apply the same logic to rules of inference.
Keep going. So
there's lots of potential. We could make up rules of inference all day. Mm-hmm. We could just make up random shit about what implies true, and some of these will be useful. Some of these will say interesting things that don't correspond to reality. Some of them will say interesting things that do correspond to reality. And those are the ones we end up using in our physical theories, because they allow us to say things about reality. So it's again about, there's a whole world of pure math. And I just include rules of inference and logic in that world. And then the ones that end up making it to our physical theories, just by evolutionarily pressure, basically, of ideas, are the ones that correspond to the actual computational rules of reality. And that's why some people are trying to posit some sort of like quantum logic. I have like no opinion about that. I don't know where that goes, but that's precisely why, right? They're saying, oh shit, maybe the rules of logic, or the rules of logic, I'm going to just use that as the same as the rules of inference. Maybe those ones only got us so far, but we actually need a more sophisticated, we need more sophisticated logical foundations for our physical theories. And so maybe we could be wrong about which rules of inference dictate reality.
So then I think we agree, like I agree that reality predates human existence, but the rules of inference and the logical systems that we invent to describe reality definitely doesn't, right? And so if you just described logic and rules of inference and formal systems as all being essentially of the character of just theories, then we are exactly back to where we started, which is you have Newton's theory, which is a conjecture about reality, and then that somehow fits to reality. But obviously, the theory would not have predated Newton. Doesn't make sense to talk about Newton's conjecture existing forever and always, and then Newton just somehow discovers his own conjecture. Similarly, it doesn't make sense to talk about prime numbers and the natural number system existing forever and always, and then we just somehow say the thing that's already existent. like what does it even mean to say it already existed before human beings? Like, you're talking about reality which already existed before human beings. Completely agree. And then there's the formal systems which we iterate on and find the ones which are fit most snugly to reality. Completely agree. But the things that we conjecture are not existent before we fucking conjecture them. They're our guesses. They are our products of our mind. Like, what does it mean to say that the prime numbers existed before human beings? That is as contradictory to me as saying conjectures exist.
I mean, I have now these two battling intuitions in my head. I totally see where you're coming from, that like, I can't really get behind that there's just like conjectures floating in the void and we're just accessing them. I agree that seems silly, but I can't also get behind the idea like we don't get to choose. Once we've chosen, it's like once you've chosen your initial conditions, you don't get the choice about what happens. The system evolves as it's going to evolve. And that's how I view choosing the language and the rules of inference. It's like you set your ground rules and then the system is completely independent of you. And now you're just like, good luck. You're trying to figure out how this system, what it looks like. And so that intuition is then pushing the completely opposite way, right? Like, we have no say over what that is. What does it even mean to say that?
But that would apply.
That's with the, dependent on us. Like, yeah. What?
That would apply equally to Vaden's unicorn theory. The whole world is built on the back of a unicorn. Okay. One of the logical consequences of that is that it's not built on the back of a horse. That is just a definitional thing that I didn't get to choose.
Yeah.
That just comes with the conjecture. It is outside of my choice.
Yeah.
And the fact that I don't get to choose the consequence of my inane conjecture, does that make the conjecture somehow timeless and deep and important or beyond me? No, of course not. It's just some stupid thing I said. And the fact that you can say stupid shit and then there's also consequences of that stupid shit doesn't give the stupid shit any primacy. Similarly, you can say brilliant and profound things. You can come up with axiomatic systems which are really foundational. And you don't get to choose the consequences there either. But that doesn't somehow mean that the consequences or the assumptions, the conjectures, exist in some timeless void. Like, that we just plug into, we just pluck off the tree, reach into the void, we tap into the conjecture space, and we just ventriloquize the things that have already been there. It's like, no, this is an act of creation. Why do we talk about creativity? Because we are creating things. Right. The word
word essentialism here.
No, but I'm so obviously nothing rides on that. But there is, I think, something true about using the word creative, because we're talking about acts of creation, right? And we are creating these things, and that's what makes it so powerful, and it's like so beautiful that we can create things that are so powerful.
Yeah, I mean, I get your intuition. I can't escape my intuition. I don't know where to go. Like, I'm just gonna keep shouting at you. But okay, yeah, I get it. I mean, you could talk about unicorns, but you could just run the argument backwards. Like, of course it has primacy because it's in Popper's World 3 and it exists. Now you're just like, you could just use emphasis of words in different ways to make certain ideas sound ridiculous. Like, it's not an argument.
No. Okay, so we should wind down since we're just reaching brute intuition at this point. But obviously the argument is not just trying to say something silly and hope that I shame my opponent, but it's more that there's nothing special or powerful or primal about the fact that we don't choose our logical consequences. That's the only point I was trying to make. And even with ridiculous conjectures, we don't choose the logical consequences either. But it seems like you really put a lot of emphasis on that. I do.
But now you're just begging the question. You're just like, there's nothing special about that. But that's what I'm arguing. There's something special about that.
But if there's something special about that, then you have to deal with the ridiculous unicorn example too, right? If there's something special about the fact that we don't choose logical
consequences. Yeah, I don't see the problem there. I mean, yeah, you didn't get to choose that your logical statement A implied once you've chosen your there, like underlying that statement is a system of logic that you've chosen to adopt, like law of excluded middle in particular.
So then why? So,
yeah, you didn't get to choose that.
But then why is the fact that you don't get to choose the logical consequences doing so much work for you? I guess like why does that the thing that is
because it's because it's the independence from humans, and so this statement that like everything that if humans disappeared, all those things would be meaningless to say that the prime numbers would disappear as well. I can't bridge that intuitional gap.
Yeah, maybe the last thing I'll say, and then we'll call it a day.
Like for Maslow's theorem doesn't stop to be true when humans disappear.
It's because you can't shake the deep knowledge you have of all the axioms and assumptions that go into it, right? So what doesn't cease to be true is the fact that if you make those assumptions and you posit those axioms, then that is a true conclusion you can discover. And it's
Of course, it's always contingent on assumptions. Everything is.
Yeah, yes. So are we saying the same thing then? That like if we didn't make those assumptions, then we would never have discovered the Fermat's last theorem?
You would never have discovered it, yeah, but it would still be true given those assumptions.
Of course, but if we don't make the assumptions.
Of course, okay, that's all I want. It would still be true given those assumptions without humans. So if we had never...
Humans don't choose the fact that there are certain things to discover within our assumptions. Of course, once you make the assumptions, there is an inevitability about that which you can discover. And that's what makes this whole enterprise of conjecture and refutation so fucking awesome. Mm-hmm. That like once you make these conjectures, you're powerless.
Yeah, because exactly. Reality kicks back because it's independent of us.
But
I know I'm kind of being unfair here. Now I'm just jumping all over your words, I'm trying to now shame you with my intuitions. No.
Well, honestly, I think that's probably as much as we could do on this subject. But well, like when we listen back, it's probably going to be 90% incoherent.
Maybe, I know. Maybe I'm worried about this one.
We may have to strike it, but I don't know. It was a dense subject, and I think we got a little bit of understanding each other's perspective.
Yeah, no, I did clarify Popper's three worlds for me, so that was good. Mm. If anything, I got that out of it. So now this viewing the three worlds as having a subset of true theories is pretty helpful. If anything, it just took me 2 hours to understand that. So,
but I guess the last thing I'll say is like if we could choose the logical consequences, if we could choose the content, then the whole thing would just be a waste of time. Like it's the fact that we can't
choose. Yeah, I totally agree, of course.
Is the reason why it's so powerful. And why the conjectures have such reach. It's like this is where the reach comes from.
Exactly.
And why conjecturing isn't just a total waste of time. But if we don't conjecture, then there's nothing to discover. All I'm saying is that the conjecture has to come first. and we can't talk about prime numbers existing without first making these conjectures in whatever form we want to make them. And it makes no sense to talk about like the number 7 being prime floating in space well before human beings made this conjecture in the first place. It's all dependent on what we...
Oh, when you put it like that...
Sorry,
I totally disagree.
Well, we'll have to let the audience decide. That was fun. Nice. To be continued, this was another small episode, but it was fun.
At some point, we'll have some legit guests on. So
yeah. All right.